Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to Shafi'i Palestine Solidarity Campaign public meeting tonight. And before I introduce our speaker tonight, I just want to mention that, unfortunately, the issue of the suffering of people of Gaza and Palestine in general has gone out from the headlines, and we're back now to reality, back to what's happening. Nobody hears about it. People now are still dying, but slowly. For instance, yesterday in my own town, Abir Elaga, a woman who needed surgery that couldn't have it in the Gaza Strip, died because she couldn't leave because of the Israeli siege. We know about this, but the people out there don't know about this, and it's very frustrating. The issue of what the Palestinians go through, and it goes unnoticed, and people show interest when the blood is shed big style, and then they lose interest. We've been seeing it, you know, over so many years, and it's happening now again, unfortunately. Israel has just elected a very right-wing government, which luckily enough will not survive. You know, everybody thinks it will not survive. They chose the foreign minister who's a racist, who wants to nuke Cairo, he wants to destroy the Aswan Dam, and now, of course, because he's the foreign minister, he's apologizing. All these things we need to keep in mind about how we're going to deal from now on with the issue of Palestine, Israel, in view of this government, which is the worst. All of them were terrible, but this one is definitely the worst by far in terms of members of it, which is not our issue tonight, but things to keep in mind. I'd like to welcome our friend here, Dr. Michael Kearney, from the Center for Applied Human Rights, University of York. Dr. Kearney has has been involved in Israel-Palestine. He's very well informed about legal issues to do with Palestine-Israel, and he's been working with Al-Haq, which is a human rights organization in the West Bank, and we are very pleased to have him here with us tonight. He will speak for 35 minutes, or as he told me, 35 minutes, and then we will have discussion. Can you please switch your mobile phones off or put them on silent? And without any further ado, Dr. Michael Kearney.
Thank you. Trying to sum up or deal with the issue of international law and how it relates to Israel-Palestine in 30 minutes is impossible, okay? So I'm going to focus primarily on what you hear in the news all the time, okay? When people talk about war crimes, when people talk about breaches of the Geneva Conventions, okay? So essentially what the Geneva Conventions provide for, what do we mean when we talk about war crimes? And try to apply this using examples from the Gaza Strip from December and January. There's a few things to kind of say, and someone was mentioning it just when I came in earlier. When you talk about law and war and the Geneva Conventions and so on, it's essentially the Geneva Conventions, okay, they're there to protect civilians, but they do allow for the killing of civilians, okay? The laws of war, except it's a body law that comes into play once a conflict starts, okay? So it accepts that, okay, we're going to have battle, we're going to have soldiers fighting each other, it's inevitable civilians are going to be killed. What the Geneva Conventions seek to do is to minimize the likelihood of that happening, okay? By regulating how do you distinguish between a civilian and a combatant? How do you distinguish between civilian objectives, military objectives? What type of weapons are you allowed to use and in which circumstances? Okay, so I'll just run through that. With regards to international law, there are bigger questions, okay, more far-reaching questions. And these relate to a debate which has only started to happen really, you know, it's popped up every so often over the past 40 years. But in the past couple of years or so, it's gaining momentum, at least in legal circles. And that relates to the lawfulness or the unlawfulness of the occupation itself. Okay, you'll be aware probably that the discourse, you know, terminology is coming into discourse in the conflict around apartheid and colonialism and so on. Okay, lawyers are starting to look at that. NGOs in Israel and Palestine are starting to look into that. You know, notables in the legal world are coming out with these type of overarching issues. Okay. Which is a case of moving on from war crimes, okay? Moving on from the case of, okay, you killed five civilians here, to look at the overarching context, okay? So maybe at the end I can come back and discuss that a little bit more detail. But for now, just basically the structure of what I'm going to do is basically set out what is the applicable law to the conflict, okay, to the occupation, which essentially is the Geneva Conventions, okay, so what does that consist of? I set out to give an outline of the principles that guide how you intended to apply the conventions, and then just to discuss, okay, we have this body of law, where do you bring it to court, okay, who can rule upon this, who can make findings of guilt or innocence and so on. So, to begin, like I said, humanitarian law is also known as the law of armed conflict, the laws of war, and it comes into application immediately on commencement of a conflict, okay? So, there's no doubt but that Israel-Palestine, the occupation, is an international armed conflict. So, the full body of international humanitarian law applies. Now, you might have heard of the International Court of Justice in 2004 gave its advisory opinion on the legality of the war. In that decision, the court said that only a certain elements of international humanitarian law applied, okay? The court made a massive error in fact and in law in that decision, okay? So even though the decision, the conclusion was correct, okay, the wall is unlawful, the method and means that the court came to come to that conclusion was incorrect. Okay, this is important to keep in mind because you will find lawyers, along with Zionists and people who are against the Palestinian cause, denying the legitimacy of that decision. Okay, and I'm just making that point because it's important not just to get to your conclusion, but also the process by which you use law. Okay. The laws of war, humanitarian law, apply equally to every party to a conflict, okay? It doesn't matter who started it, okay? It doesn't make any finding of responsibility of guilt or otherwise for who initiated the conflict. There's four Geneva Conventions. The first two deal with wounded and shipwrecked and so on. The third Geneva Convention deals with the treatment of prisoners of war. The fourth deals with the protection of civilians. And the main section, the main body of the fourth Geneva Convention deals with the protection of civilians under occupation. Okay? Excuse me. So just to sum up in general what the Geneva Conventions and humanitarian law has to say, the International Committee of the Red Cross, which is the body responsible overall for the Geneva Conventions, has a list of the seven fundamental rules, okay? So I'm just going to read out these seven fundamental rules because in total, you know, the body of humanitarian law is, you know, it's massive, okay? But essentially, this is all it means. Okay, so the first rule, persons are to combat, okay? The wounded, the sick, and so on, or people who have surrendered. And those who do not take a direct part in hostilities are entitled to respect for their lives and their moral and physical integrity. They shall in all circumstances be protected and treated humanely without distinction. 2. It is forbidden to kill or injure an enemy who surrenders or who is hors de combat. 3. The wounded and sick shall be collected and cared for by the party to the conflict which has them in its power. 4. Captured combatants and civilians under the authority of an adverse party are entitled to respect for their lives, dignity, and so on. They shall be protected against all acts of violence and reprisals. 5. Everyone shall be entitled to benefit from fundamental judicial guarantees. No one will be held responsible for an act he has not committed. No one shall be subjected to physical or mental torture, punishment, or cruel or degrading treatment. 6. Parties to a conflict and members of their armed forces do not have an unlimited choice of methods and means of warfare. It is prohibited to employ weapons or methods of warfare of a nature to cause unnecessary losses or excessive suffering. 7. Parties to a conflict shall at all times distinguish between civilian population and combatants in order to spare civilian population and property. Neither the civilian population as such nor civilian persons shall be the object of attack. Attacks shall be directed solely against military objectives. Okay? So, that's the basic principle of the Geneva Conventions, the humanitarian law. Obviously, you know, you can say, okay, you have to distinguish between civilians and combatants. It's not always easy, okay? In circumstances like in Gaza, the Israeli army will say, how can we distinguish between civilians and combatants when Hamas militants don't wear a uniform, don't carry their arms openly, you know, they don't have military camps, and so on. So it's very easy for what is a simple rule to be clouded in doubt, okay? When coming to determinations of fact. So I'm just going to mention the key principles which are supposed to assist in determining whether someone's civilian or whether an attack on a particular object is legitimate or not. So these key principles are distinction between military and civilian, proportionality, okay? So if you're targeting a military object and you know, it's surrounded by civilians, is it legitimate to attack that military objective when you know civilians are going to be killed? Okay, they're used to test the proportionality. If you're going to kill 5 civilians and 50 militants, that's probably going to be considered proportionate. If you're going to kill 5 militants and 50 civilians, that's probably not going to be proportionate. Okay, so you're basically weighing up the military advantage to be gotten by killing civilians or not killing civilians in a particular circumstance, okay? And that's how the laws of war work. It's not pretty, okay? Means and methods of warfare, it basically refers to what type of weapons you can use, okay? And that's what we're international law relating to human rights or humanitarian law. That's where it has its genesis, back in the late 19th century. There was the first treaty of any kind dealing with war. It's known as the Declaration of St. Petersburg, where the European powers prohibited the use of dum-dum bullets on the basis that... Are you aware what a dum-dum bullet is? Yeah, well, a dum-dum bullet is it's just a normal bullet, but it's got a scratch on top, where a normal bullet will hit the individual... And, you know, you'll be dead or wounded. You'll assumedly not be able to continue fighting. A dum-dum bullet will also hit you and prevent you from fighting anymore. But where a normal bullet will go in and go out and leave you wounded, a dum-dum bullet will bounce around the body, so it'll rip your insides apart. And, you know, basically it was prohibited because it was unnecessary. You know, if you can kill someone with a normal bullet, why use the type of weapon that's going to cause unnecessary suffering, okay? It's the same principle with poisonous gases, okay? You can drop a bomb on soldiers and kill them, that's okay, but you're not allowed to use poisonous gases because it's such a painful death, okay? So that's what we talk about when you talk about means and methods of warfare. And finally, I'll just mention precautions in attack, which means... Before you attack a particular area, what precautions are you supposed to take to warn civilian population that an attack is about to take place? First, I want to just give a quick outline of what kind of actions we mean when we talk about war crimes. War crimes, I'm just going to... This isn't the list of every type of war crime. It's just examples, the prime examples. War crimes... include willful killing of civilians, torture, okay, of civilians or of military, torture is absolutely prohibited. Destruction of civilian property, which isn't justified by military necessity. Deportation of civilians. Hostage taking. Killing prisoners of war. The transfer of civilians into occupied territory. Okay, so the settlements in the West Bank, that's a war crime. Declaring no quarter. Okay, if you say, okay, we're not going to take any prisoners, that in itself is a war crime, okay, because the other side has to be given the opportunity to surrender. Pillage, rape, sexual slavery, and starvation of civilians. Okay, so they're examples of war crimes. Okay, so with regards to the principle of distinction, there's a requirement that, and again, this, just, you know, at the end, we'll have a chance to ask questions. So if I'm going through things a bit too fast, we can discuss them in a bit more detail. Principle of distinction. Basic requirement is that parties to a conflict must at all times distinguish between civilian objects and military objects. So civilians are those who are not members of a party to an armed conflict. Therefore, they are not to be a target of attack unless and for such time as they take a direct part in hostilities. Okay? So a civilian is defined as being not a combatant. Okay? With regards Gaza, the civilian population includes the police force. Okay? Police forces are assumed to be civilian. So the attack, the first attack in Gaza in December, where the police station was attacked, that was a war crime, okay? The Israelis made the claim that, you know, this is the general claim, that it's not just a claim, it was their declared intention, that in attacking Gaza, we're going to attack all Hamas-affiliated institutions, buildings, people, and so on, okay? So yeah, the police force was affiliated with Hamas, but they weren't combatants, okay? There's police force. So that's a war crime. Neither does it include political representatives, okay? Political representatives are civilians. So, again, I mean, Israel has a policy of targeting Hamas politicians. I'm going to cite examples which are given in an Al-Haq brief, which was published in January before the offensive before Castellet was finished. So they give an example. Under international humanitarian law, representatives of the political wing of the Hamas government who play no part in commanding or controlling the military wing and who do not take a direct part in hostilities are civilians and are not a legitimate military target. An example of an attack on political representatives was the 1st of January aerial bombardment of Jabiya and the home of Nizar Rayan, which killed him and 15 members of his family, including 11 children, injured other family members and neighbours, and destroyed 10 adjacent houses. Okay? So that's an example of a war crime in that, you know, you're not distinguishing between civilians and military. Attacks on civilians, which constitutes willful killing, it's supposed to, in that instance, what you have is individual criminal responsibility. So those individuals who conducted the attack, who planned, who ordered this attack, can all be brought before a court and held to be individually responsible for this action. You might also have heard of, I should get to say this now, crimes against humanity. Okay, we've got four crimes in international law that are relevant here. We've got war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, and aggression. So aggression is the invasion of one state by another state. Genocide is with intention of destroying a people, an ethnic, national, religious group, in whole or in part. Crimes against humanity are war crimes that are conducted on a systematic and widespread basis. And war crimes are the individual acts of willful killing, starvation, rape, killing of prisoners of war and so on that I mentioned. So I'm going to be talking here about war crimes exclusively, although an argument can be made that, you know, we've gone beyond the stage of war crimes in Gaza. That's due to them being widespread and systematic. You can talk of crimes against humanity. Regards the distinction between civilian and military objectives, buildings and so on, Geneva Conventions basically set forth civilian objectives are all those which are not military objectives. Civilian objectives can be attacked if they're being used for military purposes, if their destruction in the circumstances provide an effective contribution to military action, and if that destruction provides for a definite military advantage. I can give another example of that. Okay, this is one which isn't justified. A characteristic example, again this is from Al-Haq, a characteristic example of an attack on a civilian object is the 6th January 2009 aerial bombardment of the Asma Bint Baker School, a facility of UNRWA. 4 days prior to the attack, UNRWA officials provided GPS coordinates to Israel, to Israeli authorities, of 23 UNRWA installations that were to be used as shelters for fleeing civilians. The location of the school was one of the 23 coordinates provided. 3 civilians were killed in the attack on the school. Okay, so again, that's a failure to distinguish between military and civilian objectives. It's a war crime. Along with the principle of distinction, you've got the principle of proportionality. Okay, so this is where you weigh up civilian casualties and military objectives, military gain. So according to the Red Cross, launching an attack which may be expected to cause incidental loss of civilian life, injury or damage, which would be excessive in relation to the concrete and direct military advantage anticipated, is prohibited. Israel, prior and during the assault in Gaza, declared its intention to destroy all Hamas-affiliated buildings, institutions and so on. They basically disregarded this principle of proportionality. Okay, essentially, there was no pretense, I don't think, at looking at an objective and saying, okay, if we attack this Hamas base, we're going to be killing 50 civilians. You know, is that justified or not? You know, that idea of, is it proportionate? That was never taken into account. It was a case of, that's an Hamas target, we're going to hit it. And, you know, the consequences on the civilian population aren't our concern. Again, an example. Examples of disproportionate use of force include the attack on the house of Hamas political representative Nizar Rayan in a densely populated neighbourhood in Jabalia, which I mentioned earlier. It was not a legitimate military target, but the attack also resulted in the killing of 15 civilians. On 29th December, in the same neighbourhood, Israeli airstrikes targeted a mosque, killing 5 sisters aged between 4 and 17 in their home, and completely destroying the mosque as well as 9 other adjacent houses. Okay, it's disproportionate military action. With regards third principle of precautions in attack, okay, which relates to warning civilians. The laws of war require that civilians be given effective advance warning of an impending assault. The party making the assault is required to take all feasible precautions in means and methods of attack. Now, you might have heard that the policy which the Israelis claimed to have had in Gaza was known as knock on the roof. Have you heard of that? Okay, this was the army policy. Okay, when they were confronted with allegations, okay, you didn't warn the civilians that you were going to attack this area. The IDF said, we have followed this procedure called knock on the roof, where we fire at the corners of a building, at the roof, and the intention is that once civilians in the building know that their building's been fired upon, that means they're supposed to leave. Okay? You'll also know that the Israelis, you know, used texts, they made phone calls, dropped leaflets and that, asking for people to, you know, warning people that they were going to be attacked. Obviously, in Gaza, where there's nowhere to go, it doesn't really mean anything anyway, you know. And 2 weeks ago, Richard Falk, he's the UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories, he issued his report on what had happened in Gaza, and he said that he didn't really look at specific violations, specific war crimes. He said, we need to look at this in totality. And he said, you know, basically, because by definition, a major assault in Gaza cannot distinguish between civilians and militants, cannot be proportionate. And basically, there's no point warning people because people have nowhere to go. So he made the claim that the entire operation should be considered to be unlawful. Okay? We can come back to that again, whether he's making novel legal arguments. In principle, he's right, but whether it'll stand before a court of law is a different matter. with regards precautions in attack and giving warnings, Al-Haq cite the example. Israel launched Operation Cast Lead without warning at 11:30 a.m., a time when urban centres across the Gaza Strip are most populated when children are changing shifts at school. Other attacks timed with an obvious expectation of devastating civilian losses include the attack on the Ibrahimi Mosque in the middle of the densely populated Jabalia refugee camp, which was hit during prayer time when it was crowded with worshippers, and attacks on some Hamas officials at times when they were surrounded by their family members. Given the location and timing of the vast majority of successive strikes, it is logical to conclude that the attacks have been conducted in expectation of incidental loss of civilian life, injury to civilians and damage to civilian objects. The Israeli occupying power has thus failed to spare the civilian population from the effects of the attack in blatant violation of international humanitarian law. With regards means and methods, I think the one example I'll use, okay, we spoke about dum-dum bullets, okay, that cause unnecessary suffering. That's the first principle. The second principle is that if you use a weapon, it should be able to distinguish between civilians and combatants, okay? So poison gas can't distinguish between civilians and combatants. You know, there's cluster bombs. Generally, the argument is that if you drop cluster bombs, they can go anywhere. So how do you know if you're not going to hit civilians? Similarly, Israel, and there's been a bit of attention paid to it over the past few months, but Israel uses these bombs that are packed with nails, with flechettes, okay? And I know they've been using them for years in Gaza. And in an area like Gaza, if you drop a bomb filled with flechettes, you're going to hit civilians with one of the nails, you know, because there's thousands of nails packed in there. The other example is the phosphorus, the white phosphorus. There's specific prohibition on the use of incendiary weapons such as white phosphorus. And I'll read the text. It is prohibited in all circumstances to make any military objective located within a concentration of civilians the object of attack by air-delivered incendiary weapons. Okay? So there's just a total prohibition on targeting military objectives with white phosphorus and the like, if they're in civilian areas. Okay, so we've gone through their basic principles of the Geneva Conventions and the laws of war. The problem you have then, okay, you gather the evidence, you can demonstrate that Israel didn't distinguish between civilians and combatants, didn't act proportionately, used prohibited weapons, didn't warn civilians, didn't give civilians the opportunity to flee the fighting. then it's a case of how do you bring people before court, okay? How do you actually apply this law? Okay, because what we have, in the most part, are the likes of Human Rights Watch, Amnesty, plus the Palestinian and Israeli organisations that are documenting all these war crimes, okay? There's a massive body of material and evidence, okay? Now, to date, it's primarily been used by campaigners in advocacy work as, okay, here we can prove that such and such happened, you know, and there's, it's systematic, there's, you know, it's not a case of a few bad eggs, it's, there's compelling, you know, overarching plans and so on. Okay, that's fine, you can use it as evidence for campaigning. But actual convictions, actual court cases are few and far between, okay? So, who has legal responsibility for the situation? In the first instance, it's the Israelis, okay? Where am I? Israel's primary responsibility for prosecuting its own people, okay, who have been alleged to commit war crimes. Now, that's never happened, okay? It's a government policy. They're not going to go prosecute individual soldiers. You might have heard that following evidence that came out a couple of weeks ago, testimonies of Israeli soldiers with regards to war crimes and so on, which is pretty blatant. The IDF instituted an inquiry which lasted for 11 days and concluded that it was just rumours. So that's not going to happen. So if Israel isn't going to do anything, whose responsibility is it? I'm coming up to my 35 minutes, but I do want to mention a case that's ongoing here in the UK at the moment.
Still got about 7 minutes, you know.
Okay. So first, the United Nations Security Council has responsibility for ensuring peace and security. So it has a role to play. It has a responsibility, okay? The primary responsibility is to place sanctions on Israel, okay? Until such time as Israel complies with the laws of war. If the Security Council fails to do so, the responsibility falls to the General Assembly of the UN, okay? Again, same idea. Sanctions on Israel of some sort to encourage them to end violations of international humanitarian law. The third responsibility, and that relates to the case that's ongoing here in the UK, relates to every state in the world is signed up to the Geneva Conventions. And Articles 1 and 146 of the Conventions place an obligation on every state, basically, that there's a duty on states individually and as a community of states to ensure respect for the Geneva Conventions. Okay, what this means is difficult to say. Okay, generally, politics and diplomacy have taken, have been to the fore over legal obligations or developing what this legal obligation means. But I'm going to come back to that anyway in a second. I just want to mention, and maybe afterwards I can talk about this again, there's a concept of universal jurisdiction. So you'll have heard of cases where Israeli generals and so on have been prosecuted in Spain, in the UK. Ariel Sharon was prosecuted in Belgium. Okay, so these are universal jurisdiction. And this principle means that, okay, typically, if you're a British citizen, you commit a crime in Britain, you're going to be prosecuted for it in Britain. Okay, if you go to the US and Britain wants you back, there's extradition proceedings, okay? But an American court isn't going to prosecute you, a British citizen, for a crime you committed while in Britain. With regards torture, genocide, piracy, and a couple of other crimes, okay, including war crimes, we have a concept of universal jurisdiction. And that means that because these crimes are so grievous, that no matter who commits them, where and when, they can be prosecuted in any court in the world, okay? Because basically it's an affront to humanity. So you remember the Pinochet case? Okay, that's what really got... This concept has always existed, but that's really what got the ball rolling, okay? So with an example like that, Pinochet, okay, he committed torture in Chile years ago, but he was subject to jurisdiction of courts in the UK and in Spain, okay? That's what universal jurisdiction means. So this is probably the major concern of the Israelis with regard likely prosecutions, is that, you know, there's a case that the Israeli general Almog landed in Heathrow in 2005, 2006, and he couldn't get off the plane. He was tipped off by...
Foreign Office.
By the Foreign Office. You know, so I mean, but this is, you know, this avenue is open, okay? So I just want to talk about the case that's ongoing. Okay, there's also the International Criminal Court. And Israel hasn't signed, ratified the statute of the International Criminal Court. So so basically it's not applicable, okay? Now, Sudan hasn't ratified the statute of the International Criminal Court either, but the Security Council of the UN, it has a power that it can step in and extend jurisdiction over Sudan without Sudan's permission, okay? Because the Security Council just has that power, okay? So it's available to the Security Council to do that with regards to Israel. Obviously, it's not going to do that. The Palestinian Authority have asked the International Criminal Court to, the prosecutor, to look at what happened in Gaza. For that to happen, the prosecutor must accept that Palestine is a state, and one of the trial chambers, the court itself, has to agree to that, okay? Now, politically, he's not going to make that decision that Palestine is a state, okay? And this is remove from the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, because the prosecutor, the International Criminal Court, is, you know, he's been criticised from every angle. So if he goes on and says Palestine's a state, he'll probably lose his job. But, you know, it's really difficult to make a compelling argument that Palestine is a state anyway, given the fact that it's so fragmented, there's lack of political leadership, the economy, and basically the occupation. So that's very unlikely to happen. The case that's ongoing at the moment is a case which Al-Haq, Palestinian Human Rights Organization, have taken against the government. And it started in January of this year. And there's a group of lawyers, chambers in Birmingham called Public Interest Lawyers. And they've taken a couple of cases with regards to Palestine and that so far in British courts. And Public Interest Lawyers. Phil Shiner is the barrister there. And the case relates to... Okay, I mentioned that every state has signed up to Geneva Conventions. Therefore, every state has a responsibility to ensure that everyone else respects them. Okay, it's mutual enforcement. So in January, Al-Haq, True Public Interest Lawyers, sent a letter to the, I think, four ministers here in the UK, including Miliband and Mandelson, saying, okay, look, this is what Israel is doing in Gaza. These are your obligations under Geneva Conventions. You have an obligation to ensure respect. What have you done? Would you mind telling us what you have done in practice? So the Treasury, I think, took it on, and the Treasury sent the letter back to Al-Haq. It's all on their website, the correspondence, saying that we've considered this and we believe that we are doing enough to satisfy the obligations under the Geneva Conventions to ensure respect. Now, they didn't say what it is that they were doing, and Al-Haq didn't accept this. So they've submitted a case to the High Court, I believe, which is asking for a judicial review. Okay, so for the British judiciary to review the political actions of these various ministries to determine whether the ministers are in keeping with their obligations under the Geneva Conventions. This hasn't happened before. generally, this is the kind of case that the courts will come down on the government side. They'll make a political decision. They'll say this is relating to international relations, foreign affairs, and really it's a political matter. And we as the judiciary don't want to be involved with issues of national security and so on. So there probably won't be a great result from this. But the more cases like this can be developed, the more jurisprudence that can be developed on this. You know, it basically undermines the British government plus other governments' claims that, you know, they act in accordance with international law and that they have respect for human rights and so on. So, I mean, hopefully the British judiciary will stand up to the politicians and, you know, conduct a judicial review and determine what it is exactly that the UK's obligations under Geneva Conventions are, you know. Specifically what Al-Haq have asked for, again, drawing on the International Court of Justice and the Wall advisory opinion, that there is an obligation on every state to ensure compliance by Israel with humanitarian law. Al-Haq has demanded evidence of actions that they have complied with the Geneva Conventions. They've asked for the export license system of military goods to Israel to be suspended. They've asked for a suspension of the EU preferential trade agreement with Israel. Suspension of British government assistance to military technological exports to Israel, whether private or state. And also that any evidence that can be given to the courts with regards cases such as Al-Mog, with regards universal jurisdiction, be pursued. Again, like I said, this hasn't happened before. Up until now, this area of law has been basically, it's just been academics arguing about it amongst themselves. So it's a positive sign that, you know, humanitarian law is coming out of that academic world and hopefully will have a practical use. So I'm conscious that I've ran through an awful lot of things there and kind of skipped over some and you know, kind of gone back and forward a little. So hopefully if there's questions, I can try and clarify things.
Thank you very much. Well, we got 35 minutes. Can we have questions first before comments, please? Can we, and then when we have comments, can we have them brief? So questions first. So, as Michael said, there's a lot of things to learn for all of us here. And we need to ask Mario.
Yeah, do you know about this case in Londonderry? And it was when Israel attacked Lebanon, mm-hmm. and there was an arms firm in Londonderry that got trashed, and mm-hmm. they used the law to successfully defend themselves.
Yeah. That was Raytheon. Yeah. Following the Good Friday peace agreement in Northern Ireland, the Good Council of Derry, which, you know, Derry is notorious for being a Republican stronghold and the Bogside and all that, decided that after all these years of fighting against British imperialism, they were going to ensure employment for the people of Derry by bringing in this weapons company so that other imperialist powers could go and use their weapons elsewhere in the world. I think there was 9 people involved. They were charged with criminal damage in a Derry court and they were acquitted by the jury. You know, the people of Derry will never prosecute someone for undertaking an action like that. And it happened again. I think they went in again last week. And there was, I think, 9 women went in and attacked it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If in order to prosecute Israel for war crimes, Palestine has to be seen as a state. And if this is this an obstacle that cannot be overcome, and are there ways to bring Israel to court?
Yeah, it's generally there's no set hard and set rules as to what criteria you have to meet to be recognised as a state, but generally speaking, you want set borders, you know, some sort of government with control over the area, and you know, things that you might, you know, things like that. And essentially, it's I don't think anyone can make an argument that Palestine is a state. You know, it would be a political decision, and I think it would be incorrect. So yeah, that rules out the International Criminal Court.
But is it in the definition of war crimes that they are acted upon states?
No. Anyone can commit a war crime. It's just when I spoke of that, I was looking for what are the options, which courts, which legal avenues can you use? And in order to use the International Criminal Court, you have to be a state. Now, the International Criminal Court prosecutes individuals. It doesn't prosecute states. But in order for an individual... You know, the only possibility really is of dual nationals. So, for example, a British citizen who's fighting in the Israeli army, because Britain has signed up to the Rome Statute, if that British citizen committed war crimes in Gaza, he or she would be subject to the court's jurisdiction. You know, so, but that's about it, really.
Yeah.
When we finish the questions, can I say something about the earlier situation?
Yes, when we
speak up.
When we finish the questions. Yeah.
My question is, you talked about there having been a whole sort of body of campaigning, there's an overwhelming evidence, but then you said that it's only really just now that lawyers are beginning to look at the options, and I wondered how much sort of organisation is going on, because one of the things that worries me is that there's a group here gathering evidence about one thing. I know the Lawyers Guild, is it in the States, went over to Gaza, and it's the beginnings now of sort of organisation, so that people are working together at all, or yeah. Not, or is everybody just doing their own thing and repeating work? I mean, how do you see
there? There is a certain element of overlap, but what has happened, I think, is especially in recent, like in this intifada, is that you've got a handful of Palestinian organisations. So I suggest Al-Haq in the West Bank and the Palestinian Centre for Human Rights in Gaza, who, as organisations that are documenting what's happening through the perspective of international law, and who have really good lawyers working for them and really good resources, and who are, you know, independent of the politics, you know, these organisations are extremely well respected by the Palestinian community, you know. So what's happening is that, yeah, you might have these various groups on their own initiative, Lawyers Guild or whoever it might be, going into the occupied territories to conduct investigations. They're all going to go and meet. If they're in Gaza, they're going to meet with PCHR. If they're in the West Bank, they're going to meet with Al-Haq. I think it's pretty much inevitable. So I think, you know, because they're going through those two hubs, there's some element of coordination. I'm working on a report at the moment myself, and we're going publishing our report in May, hopefully. And, you know, there's people working on that from, you know, there's NGOs, there's Adala in Israel, Al-Haq in the West Bank. And then you've got, it's funded by the South African Research, Human Sciences Research Council. So you've got South African lawyers, politicians involved. You've got people from all over the world, you know, working on a massive report. So there is an increasing amount of coordination.
Just to follow on from your question, does it matter if a case is repeated? For instance, if somebody files a case in Spain and somebody else does it in America, and the same case is done in England.
No, it doesn't.
Strengthen the case or not, does it? I mean, after all, the only thing we can get is publicity. I mean, nothing will happen to these people.
Yeah. It's better to coordinate. It's better not to... Well, you can't have the same case twice in one jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. You can't be prosecuted twice for...
Okay.
That's, can't remember what the expression is for that, but... So there's a case in Spain at the moment, and that's that relates to the killing of Salah Shahada in 2002.
That's Dan Almog.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's ongoing in Spain. Moshe Yalon, who was a general.
Yes, he was the head of commander-in-chief.
Yeah. But there was an arrest warrant issued against him in New Zealand. A few years back, relating to that
but
case
Hickman,
as well.
Hickman and Rose took this case up in London.
Okay, well that's...
So there's two cases. I mean, I think it's strengthened the case because, I mean, we are trying to bring publicity to...
Yeah.
I'm just asking, you're the expert, but...
Yeah, I've never actually thought of that about whether...
Because the as we saw from Almog, as you mentioned, he was tipped off by the Foreign Office, so they're well connected.
Yeah.
Nobody will take it.
I was more thinking about on the ground... individual Palestinians being interviewed three times over by, at that sort of level organisation.
Yeah. Okay, your question, please.
You mentioned white phosphorus. What about other illegal weaponry that was used as dense inert metal explosives, dime weapons, and depleted uranium?
Mm.
Do you understand about those?
Okay, there has been evidence collected with regards to that, but I haven't been following exactly. I'm not an expert on munitions or that. To be honest, no other than the white phosphorus and the flechettes, I don't know exactly what else. But generally, I mean, the principle is that, look, flechettes and white phosphorus aren't banned, okay? It's how they're used, how they're employed, and basically using them in a densely populated area like Gaza, that's what the problem is. With regards... depleted uranium in that. I know there's an ongoing debate with regards to their legality and how they're used and their actual effects, you know, because it seems to be all denial and counterclaim that, so I can't answer that, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Your question, please.
I found the first part of your talk very interesting and informative. Like, some of the things that you highlighted raises, like, the hypocrisy and the kind of, like, ridiculousness of international law, especially relating to war. Like, it's kind of ridiculous. It's Kafkaesque, and it would be funny if it wasn't, like, relating to the devastation of people's lives. In relation to the second part of your talk, I think the most important part there, and you did touch on it, is that, you know, law, even nationally, law is not separated between, you know...
Can we have this is questions now, not the comments. Please.
You know, politics has played a major role, and that's even more relevant internationally. And when we're talking about enforcement, what we really want to talk about is, you know, the agency of enforcement. And, you know, for things like the UN, really, you read the US, you know, it's the same thing. So, you know, the US, and you mentioned some of the things to do with the Geneva Convention and international law, so crimes on, like, against humanity, aggression, war crimes, I couldn't remember the fourth one, but, you know, these are all things that America will happily breach, you know, they have breached in the last couple of years. So, you know, what do you think about... what agency is going to be enforcing these if it's not going to be, you know, the US or the major, like, Western states that really follow the US's, like, foreign policy? And the second question was to do with the sanctions that you mentioned, whether or not you think that would be a valid way to kind of enforce international law in terms of, you know, in the past when sanctions have been used, they're never really effective against the state or the government. All they really do is affect, like, you know, the poorest element of that state.
Okay. Regards to the first point of your question, okay? International law is not perfect, okay? There's a phrase, okay? International law is not a suicide club for states, okay? Because it's states who create this and who apply it and so on, okay? It's up to the human rights lawyer on the ground in his little chamber to try and harass them and hold their... So you can use it, okay, to measure whether a state has complied with their own, what they claim to abide by, you know, their own standards. Then you have to remember that, you know, when the Nazis were being tried at Nuremberg, they were being charged with war crimes, crimes against humanity and aggression. And their defence just said, you know what, none of these exist, you know, and they were right. You know, those crimes didn't exist. There was, you know, if you wanted to, you know, slaughter, you know, your people in your own country on their ethnic, religious, or whatever basis, you could do that. There was no law against it, you know. If you wanted to bomb Dresden and kill, destroy the entire city, that was fine. You know, it wasn't illegal. So we've got to the point now where we have the laws in place, okay? Where you've got the criminal tribunals in Yugoslavia, in Rwanda, which happened after conflicts, or during conflict in Yugoslavia and after the Rwandan genocide, and which were only possible because the Cold War was finished and there was that possibility for that kind of consensus. So you have Milosevic in the dock. You have the Rwandan president during the time of the genocide was convicted. He's in jail. So there are success stories, okay, with regards to international law. Now, they're not adequate, and, you know, it's a big criticism of the International Criminal Court at the moment, because its cases are Sudan, Congo, Central African Republic, and Uganda. It's, you know, it's targeting African states, okay? And that's a fact. So, you know, it's how do you move it forward, how do you develop it, rather than... Because it's very easy to knock international law, you know, it's very easy. And, you know, so hopefully we can take it forward somehow. With regard to sanctions, I mean, it depends how they're used. You know, like the sanctions regime against Iraq was obviously a disaster at every level, from political to humanitarian. You know, sanctions regime against Israel, you know, you don't have to do very much. You know, stop exporting weapons. You know, place a weapons ban on Israel. You know, even just leave it at that for the start and move forward.
But then, who is selling the weapons to Israel?
Who is?
Yeah.
Well, if you do get sanctions, that would have to be the Security Council.
Yes.
You know, which would mean, not to say this is going to happen. You know, I'm saying it should, but
more targeted.
Yeah. Yeah.
Last week's Jewish Chronicle on its front page expressed outrage that the British government alleged had reneged on its promise to Israel that it would change the law so as to make it impossible to prosecute Israeli politicians on war crimes. So my question is, what is a law that they had allegedly promised to change, and could they change it?
Mm-hmm. The law, again, this relates to the concept of universal jurisdiction, and specifically here, you're talking about a couple of pieces of legislation in the UK. There's the Geneva Conventions Act, which incorporates the Geneva Conventions into the domestic law of the United Kingdom. So Geneva Conventions provide that individuals responsible for grave breaches, for war crimes and so on, have to be brought to court. So that's part of British law. And then there's I don't have the exact title, but there's a piece of legislation which prohibits torture and provides that there's universal jurisdiction for the crime of torture. So anybody, whether it be Pinochet or whether it be Israelis who are in the British jurisdiction and who are alleged to have committed war crimes, any individual can file a complaint. I think it's at a magistrate's court. I'm not quite sure of the technicalities now of UK domestic law on this. But basically, usually what happens, for example, with Almog, will be that barrister's chambers will go to a magistrate's court or the High Court, I'm not sure, and basically provide them with a file. Okay, we've got evidence that this individual has committed war crimes. Here's their evidence. Please, we request you issue an arrest warrant. And in certain instances, if the judge finds the evidence is compelling enough, he'll issue the arrest warrant. This arrest warrant basically will constitute a summons to a criminal investigation and will lead to the individual will come before the court and make his argument, no, I didn't commit war crimes, no, you've got no jurisdiction over me. And if the person who asked for the warrant can provide evidence, compelling evidence of war crimes or torture, then that's the initiation of criminal proceedings. So it'll be decided by the magistrates.
Mm-hmm. Before,
could they change it?
They could change it. And to give an example, okay, they could change it, but it would be saying, it would be giving two fingers to the Geneva Conventions.
Mm-hmm. They'd have to derogate from the Geneva Conventions.
You can't derogate from the Geneva Conventions.
You can't?
No. You can derogate from human rights law. So when you're talking about freedom of expression and you know, the right to a fair trial, you know, detention without trial and detention without charge and all that, you can derogate from that because that's in peacetime. But when you talk about war, you can't derogate.
Mm-hmm. What does derogate mean, by the way?
Sorry, derogate.
Not in lawyer's terms.
Yeah.
I can see it moving to lawyer's terms.
Yeah. Okay, I'll give an example.
Me, no English, no understanding.
A derogation is, for example, under the European Convention on Human Rights, everyone has a right to a fair trial.
Mm-hmm.
A state can do what's called derogate. A state can derogate from the right to a fair trial if there's a public emergency. Okay, so if the state is facing a threat, public emergency constituting a threat to the life of the nation, it will say to the European Court, because it is a threat to our state, we're going to derogate because we can't provide the right to a fair trial in the same way, in the same manner that we would in peacetime. You know, so again, if you look at Northern Ireland, the UK derogated with regards to fair trial. So then you can go and intern thousands of people as, and the case here, the, you know, derogated against fair trial with regards terrorism suspects.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what a derogation means.
Yeah. Before we move to the last two questions, it's just the name Almagro has been mentioned many times, and I'm just concerned that some of us here might not know the story. Dan Almagro was the head of the Israeli Air Force. In the year 2002, the Israeli Air Force dropped 1,000 kilogram, one ton bomb on the house of Salah Shahada, the leader of the military wing of Al-Qassam, of Hamas Al-Qassam Brigades. In the process, of course, they destroyed many houses and killed 16 people, including 9 children. And then a case was brought against Dan Almog by PCHR, which is the Palestinian Center for Human Rights in Gaza, and lawyers in London called Hickman and Rose. And they managed to get a warrant for his arrest. This is the type of thing we should be really working on, because the Israelis are well protected. I mean, if the summit of the Arab countries and the European and American administration to reconstruct Gaza didn't mention who destroyed Gaza, you know, the whole summit didn't mention that Gaza was destroyed by Israel, what kind of living protection is this? You know, so what, you know, let's be realistic about what we can do. We need to make these people pay. At least they know they cannot leave Israel. That's our target. That's our target. That's the war crime cases target should be, in a realistic way, because they are very well protected. Your question, then Johnny, then the last question there, and then we'll move to comments.
My question is a bit of a comment, but there is a question tied up in there, so it's going to take a bit longer than just what do you think of this, I'm afraid. We've already had, you know, Jamie asking the question about international law and agency, and how do you plan to take this forward, and from what you said, it was kind of hopefully we can find a way.
Mm-hmm.
You did come up with some examples where things have been done under international law, have been good. As you said, there was a tendency to go around African countries and not the Western world. The reason Israel's able to do what it does fundamentally is because it's supported by the Western world,
mm-hmm.
by Britain, by America, by everything like this. In America alone, you know, the Iraq war breached UN conventions, mm-hmm. but went ahead. There was a democratic election held in Iraq when the country was in as far as I know, is against... Mm-hmm. international law. So I don't see there's any agency currently with Israel's getting support from us and America that it could be taken forward into international law. I think what it does is lead you down a blind alley, lead you to a world where you can't actually get anywhere. What we would argue for is a fundamental shift that, you know, working class people in Israel, in Gaza, in Palestine, in Britain, in America need to stand up and fight their own government. And until that happens, I think talking about international law, it's very, very dangerous and distracts all our attention from what mm-hmm. should happen. So I just wondered what you thought of that, and again, with sanctions effect,
okay,
working class people to organise like that.
Yeah, basically what I'd say is that you shouldn't look at those two things as being mutually exclusive, you know? You know, again, going back to Northern Ireland, you know, the IRA strategy, Sinn Féin, was the ballot and the, what was it, the ballot box and the Armalite, you know, so you could take, a similar approach with regards law, you know. You could have on the one side your political campaigning for whatever approach you think is the best way, and on the other side, use the law. By using the courts, right, if you lose every case, if you never win, basically what you're demonstrating is the hollowness of the system, that the law that is in place is, is a farce, is a mirage, you know, that it's there for us to use against the weak, against Africa and so on. Okay, we can use it against Bashir in Sudan, but we're not going to use it against Tony Blair. Okay, and that's fine. But so long as the law is there, you're going to have people saying, if you go talking about organising to fight against your government, they'll say, but look, there's a democratic system in place where you can use the courts to make your argument. And unless you've used that, if you use the courts and you lose the whole time, then you can turn around and say, okay, I've used the courts, I've no option left. Okay, the UN Charter and the Universal Declaration provides that if man is not to have recourse to rebellion, okay, it provides for a right of rebellion against your government. And it says, if you don't have your human rights, if you don't have the rule of law and democracy, everyone has a right to rebellion. So that's why I said international law isn't perfect, but it's there, you know. So
yeah, there was a second part to the question about the sanctions and affecting the working class, which keeps coming up, and
yeah,
if you want to take it, please.
It's not affecting the working class. It was linked to the first part, with the working class can't organise when the sanctions on, and if you look at countries like Iraq and like Iran, it's just proven that it's very difficult to work
with.
Okay. Johnny?
Yes. I just wanted to pick up on Paul. Paul, you talked about, the article was talking about politicians, and is that right? And I was just wondering where the dividing line and responsibility is. I mean, you talked about the head of the Israeli Air Force, and is the is responsibility only upward in a hierarchy, or can that any member of the Knesset who happens to be travelling in Europe and campaigning for Israel, can they be arrested under, who is responsible for these?
It's not going to be the same in, it depends how a particular country, how their political military system. Somewhere like Israel, you kind of take pretty much anyone in the Knesset, because the military and the government is so linked, you know. But essentially, what you need to show is evidence that this individual, be they a politician, be they a religious leader, be they a soldier, that they had some link to the crime committed, to the specific crime.
So we're talking about a specific event
that links that to a specific crime. So to go up to... And this is the thing the Americans American lawyers have been fighting with, is, with regards Abu Ghraib and torture and that, is, okay, we prosecuted the soldiers in Abu Ghraib for committing these crimes, but how far up the chain does it go, you know? And just getting the evidence is the difficult part, you know. With Israel and Israeli politicians, it's generally pretty easy, because they're very outspoken and very honest about what they do. Bold, as we'd say, you know. So, yeah, it depends on how much evidence you have, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And sort of, I think you've touched on that, on the question that I was going to ask. We're waiting for international law to come out of its closed academia. But meanwhile, don't you think, my question is, practically, don't you think that the road of immigration legislation is a much underused road around European countries, that we can prosecute many a big name who are clearly implicated in crime, rather than waiting for this big gun of the trial that you mentioned here in London, where they've asked the foreign ministry, mm-hmm. can resort to sort of street fighting, tax targeting people,
mm-hmm.
and then even if they're tipped through an act of complicity by the foreign office, the police, that makes them sort of cloistered in their so-called state,
mm-hmm.
and it will apply a lot of pressure. Is it not an underused tactic? Don't you think it is?
Yeah. I completely agree. There's a lot of avenues provided for in law that haven't been used in the way that that there might be possibility to, you know. Now, what's happened is that, it's an example I meant to mention earlier, in Belgium had legislation on its books providing for universal jurisdiction, which meant that for any serious crime anywhere in the world, the Belgian courts would be open to it. So, like, by the time, by around 2001, 2002, you had Arias Sharon before the courts in Belgium. He'd been indicted anyway. He physically wasn't there for Sabra and Shatila. You had Arafat before the courts for suicide bombings. You had Belgians, French, Japanese, Chinese, people from all over the world regards different conflicts. And the Belgian courts were dealing with all these issues, even though it had a lot of them had nothing to do with Belgium. And not only is this logistically difficult for the Belgian system, politically, suddenly everyone's angry with the Belgians, you know. The Palestinians are angry with them, the Israelis are angry with them. And it's because Belgium was the only one that was willing to do this, they had all the pressure. And then they just had to adapt their laws. And they said, okay, we'll keep the principle, but only if there's a Belgian citizen directly involved. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's what happens if everyone kind of piles into one jurisdiction and tries to use what's available. But you're right, and it's, you know, there's cases ongoing in Spain at the moment. Again, with regards Almog and the killing of Shahada and that. It's difficult because local judges don't want to be involved with international politics. And politicians don't want cases against Israel to be brought against, be brought in their own courts. Because politically, even if they agree with it politically, they're like, we don't need the trouble. You know? But you're right, it does need to be developed a lot more.
I just want to say something brief about the sanctions thing. I mean, I think, you know, Israel applies sanctions against the Palestinians, mm-hmm. At the moment, effectively, denying them, you know, the means of, you know, a decent life. And I think, you know,
a life,
yeah,
basic life, nothing decent.
Yeah, well, outside of the war situation, you know, and it links up with the academic boycott idea. You know, I personally support the idea of an academic boycott and support the idea of sanctions. And I think the parallel isn't Iraq, it's South Africa. You know, we had a meeting the other week when we talked about this, and, you know, anti-apartheid organisations in South Africa, you know, the black working class, wanted sanctions,
mm-hmm.
because they saw that as a way of damaging the regime. And it's the same. You know, and the white working class, South Africans, didn't want sanctions because they actually got benefits, privileges, a better deal than the black working class, you know, and that's why they supported apartheid. And that goes for, you know, the majority, unfortunately, of the Israeli working class.
Absolutely.
So I just think that, you know, it's a divide and rule thing, but basically the Israeli working class have got to wake up to the idea that their best interests are in fighting for working class solidarity. But, you know, it doesn't look like it's going to happen anytime soon, unfortunately.
Yeah. It's 7 minutes to nine. We still got some time, and it's time for my question. Now I've given everybody the chance. No. It's just really, we have a big group in Sheffield, and we are growing, and we have so many good people of so many different backgrounds who support us. And I'd like to ask you, is it worth that in Sheffield, and we have the people who can do that. Mm-hmm. We have the contacts with Gaza that we can do that. Is it worth targeting a case that has not been touched? We know so many. I know personally of so many cases around my own community back in the Gaza Strip, which hasn't been mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, killing of 3 children here, 2 children there, targeting people on bicycles, things like this. Is it worth? And again, I'm being realistic. I'm not drawing dreams here. I'm dreaming of like that mm-hmm. these people would be brought. But it's a way of like showing how criminal these people are, how criminal this state is.
Mm-hmm.
Is it worth working on a case like that or not?
It is work. But you've got... I mean, I was saying it's a good idea, okay, and it needs to be developed more. But to do so, you need to have a really strong case.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And you don't need a really strong likelihood of succeeding.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But you want to have a watertight case, basically. So if you, okay, if it's, there's evidence of a war crime being committed, okay, let's say the killing of children in Gaza, you know, can you establish who is responsible for it, okay, who is the commanding officer, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now,
easy.
If you can discover who that is, okay, if they're Israeli citizenship only, it's one thing, okay? Maybe there's enough crimes committed, you could find someone who has dual citizenship, okay? That way you don't have to deal with universal jurisdiction. You can find a British citizen who's responsible, okay? In thinking of doing anything like this, you need to talk with the Palestinian NGOs,
mm-hmm.
okay?
Yes.
Because they have strategies, long-term strategies, as to how to use the different courts in different countries over a period of time. So that's who I'd stop and talk to first, okay? And say, mm-hmm. look, we have resources, we have interest, and this is something we'd like to pursue. You know, maybe they'd say, okay, you know, we have a case where we could do with some assistance. It's in the first instance, it's the thing the Israelis are most afraid of, okay, yes. most worried about, and will get most irritated about as well, because it presents them as common criminals, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So they're standing, you know, if the Israelis have been prosecuted in cases like this, then they're up there with the likes of Bashir in Sudan,
yeah.
and so on. Okay, obviously, which they don't want.
It is worth it.
It is worth it, yeah. But talk to the Palestinian organizations.
Yeah. In this case, I mean, I'd like to invite people, if they're interested in discussing this topic, to our next planning meeting, which is here in the Quick Meeting House. Is it next Tuesday? Mm-hmm. And then if people have ideas, only if people are interested, they can come along, and then we can put it as one item and talk about it generally and see how we can do it. Because I think Sheffield is qualified, if it's worth it, to at least, you know, file a case from Sheffield, you know, by the people of Sheffield who support the Palestinians against one of these commanders who carried out these attacks. I just want to mention al-Bashir, and I'm not defending al-Bashir at all. Darfur, what happened in Darfur is awful. But just to give you a piece of information, before, what was the court, which international...
Yeah, the International Criminal Court.
International Criminal Court, court issued its decision. Al-Bashir received many delegations, and it's documented, from Arab diplomats who were representing the Americans and the Europeans, etc. And they offered him explicitly that if you sever links with Iran, if you sever links with Syria, if you reduce contact with so many different organizations, this case, this file will disappear. And the man refused. And immediately after a few months, that happened. There is a lot of hypocrisy, which you touched on, and it's disgusting, you know. Well, I think we were very privileged to have you, Michael. I mean, for one, I'm talking about myself. We use the terms war crimes and crimes against humanity, etc. But tonight we had a chance. You'll make an announcement. You know?
Well, I want to talk about the earlier, because it's exactly about
yeah.
I just wondered if I could do that, because you might have something to say.
Yes, yeah, I'll give you the chance before I close, yeah. Yeah, and I'll give you the chance now, and then I'll close. Because I lost my concentration. Okay. Karen.
I think one of the issues about concentrating on Gaza at the moment is Israel does what it always does, is hide all the other things that it carries on doing. So what's been happening in the West Bank over the last few months has been completely out of the news, and that's what Israel does all the time. Which brings me to the international campaign against Veolia. Veolia is who collects our bins in Sheffield, and they're involved, complicit in the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from Jerusalem. by being involved in the tramway system in Jerusalem. So there's an international campaign against Veolia, and it involves people from Sweden, France, Holland, I think Australia, as well as people in Britain. So in Sheffield, we're involved in two lines of attack, if you like, against Veolia. One is that they've got a transport contract in Rotherham, and that's up for renewal. And Hickman and Rose, so that's the same solicitor who has taken the case against the general whose name I've forgotten.
Almog.
Couldn't get out of the plane. It's the same solicitor, Daniel Makover, who's founded Lawyers for Palestinian Human Rights. One of our members is instructing Daniel. Daniel thought of it first, but so a Sheffield person is instructing Daniel to mount a legal challenge against the renewal of that transport contract in Rotherham. So that's one line of attack, and the other one is us pressurising Sheffield City Council regarding the contract they've got with Veolia for waste disposal across the city. It can also be widened to incorporate things like the fact that, for instance, the universities and all major organisations within Sheffield also contract with Veolia. And so the argument is that Veolia is complicit in war crimes, in the transfer of people into occupied territory. So it's exactly the same, you know, issues that we're talking about in relation to the Gaza war crimes. And I think one of the issues is it's not just about whether we win or lose these cases, because it's also not about Veolia. It's about highlighting what Israel's doing. And as we've been talking to people about Veolia, it's been a way of explaining to people what's happening in Jerusalem, the way thousands and thousands of Palestinians are being driven out of the city. So to me, it's a really useful campaigning tool. So I just wanted to make people aware of that. We are already taking the legal route as one of the... I am, you know, very sceptical about international law for the same reasons that lots of people here have, but I see it as a tool, and a tool that if we can use against people in power, then we should. So that's what we're doing in Sheffield.
Thank you very much, Hilary. At the end of our meeting, as I said, we are very privileged to have you, Michael, because we use the terms war crimes, and we use it out of our... believe in them, but without like having the legal background to it. And I will certainly, for one, go away from this meeting very focused on the fact that Israel has committed war crimes in the Gaza Strip, and has been committing it before even that attacks. For instance, you mentioned the destruction of civilian property, for goodness sake. I mean, tens of thousands of houses in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, destruction of people's lives, of killing of civilians, etc. So... well, we are more focused, really, after what you told us. And hopefully we will come out with something. We'll keep pushing the issue of war crimes that have been committed. And we will keep pushing the issue that Israel isn't the state that people think it is, including some of our even supporters. You know, you get these voices all the time that are talking about Israel as a democratic country which is doing naughty things or doing bad things. And this must disappear from our... dictionary, out of belief, out of educating ourselves, not out of like indoctrination or believing, no, out of learning about what happens and making sure that what we are dealing against. And let me remind you as well of the government that has been elected in Israel, which is the most right-wing of all right-wing governments, and I just couldn't believe how somebody like Avigdor Lieberman is the foreign minister of Israel, a man with his views, a man with his very racist, anti-Palestinian, anti-Arab, extreme Zionist views, a man who just came to the country in 1979 and thinks the indigenous people of the country shouldn't live in it. So it's like it's a mystery. But that's hopefully will expose the face of Israel. Thank you very much again, Michael, and thank you all for coming. It's been a good meeting, good turnout. And hopefully you continue to support our activities. We don't want to reach a stage where people will forget about what's happening. Hot or cold, bloodshed or not bloodshed, Palestinians are being denied of their most basic human rights. Israel's committing crimes all the time against the Palestinians, committing war crimes. Gaza or not Gaza, West Bank, against refugees, everything. Let's continue to fight for justice. Thank you all very much. And please join me here in time. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.